The Anchor podcast platform I've been using since my first podcast in September 2018 was acquired by Spotify in 2019 and has now been rebranded as Spotify for Podcasters. Thanks to the great Anchor team that made it free and easy to get started and to publish 44 episodes so far. Thanks to Mike McNano, Nir Zickerman, Maya Prohovnik, John Lagomarsino, Armand Wilson, Ryan Rosa, and a special thanks to my son Dave, who when he joined Anchor as head of marketing in 2017, said to me, "Hey Pops, you really ought to start a podcast." And so I did. And now for today's episode.
Tvetan Todorov writes an article where he argues that the murder mystery is a story about reading and writing, where, let me get it right, the reader and the detective are poised against the writer and the criminal to work out the narrative of what happened. There's also a lot of narratology about where the narrative starts. It's all terribly technical after that, but I was very intrigued by this notion that this is really a book about reading and writing, not about killing people or justice or anything like that. That's Todorov's argument.
From Bookworms in the Wild and from Spotify, I'm Howard Alterescu, and this is my podcast where I ask people I find interesting to tell me what they're reading. Recently, I've also asked a number of my guests about what they've written, which is again the case today. It's also again the case that I met our guest today at a Woodstock dinner party at the home of Abigail Sturgis and Dan Perry. Thanks, Abigail and Dan, for being such a rich source of interesting authors and podcast guests. Before I welcome my guest, let me briefly mention some books I'm currently enjoying. I'm reading and very much enjoying Alessandro Manzoni's The Betrothed, I Promessi Sposi, sometimes referred to as a cornerstone of Italian culture, language, and literature, and an exemplary 19th century historical novel. And it's really good. Reading this one in small bites over 49 days with an online group, including Tori, hosted by translator Michael Moore, and a public space, which is an independent nonprofit publisher that, at the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, created an online book club, APS Together. Really terrific. Check it out. I'm also reading People of the Book by Geraldine Brooks. I loved her historical novel, Horse, and People of the Book is another deeply researched historical tale. Mixing fact and fiction, it's about the travels and travails of a Haggadah, over 500 years from its creation in Spain at the time of the Inquisition to its restoration in Sarajevo at the end of its civil war, particularly moving as Passover approaches. My brothers and I have also been reading James Joyce's epic Ulysses. This one's going to take some time, and it's a good thing there are so many podcasts and other sources to explain it all to us. I understand that many people give up on Ulysses because of its complexity. We're going to try to see it through and to appreciate it as well. And now for today's guest, Erica Obi. Erica is a graduate from Yale University and has an MA in creative writing from City College of New York and a PhD in comparative literature from the City University of New York, where she published articles and a book about female folklorists of the 19th century. In addition to the book we'll talk about today, The Brooklyn North Murder, Erica is the author of six other mysteries, mostly set in the Hudson Valley. Erica is also the past president of the New York chapter of Mystery Writers of America. I loved hearing about that as the office of the Mystery Writers of America was in the same apartment building that Carol and I lived in on 19th Street in Manhattan when we moved to New York from Boston in the 1970s. We always thought that it was a bit eerie to have a bunch of mystery writers running around the building. Welcome, Erica.
Thank you.
As you know, I had Allison Galen and Wendy Corsi Staub on the podcast not too long ago. So you're my third mystery writer guest, and I'm so glad to have you on the podcast. When I met Erica and asked her what she was reading, she told me that she was just completing writing a mystery novel. And Erica, your mystery novel is also a detective story and a bit of a thriller. Before we all learned about ChatGPT, I might have also used the term science fiction to describe your book. This is a fun read, an old-fashioned murder mystery that also includes, most notably, an AI bot, which sounds like some form of ChatGPT. The AI bot in your novel is programmed by your principal protagonist, Mary Watson, a college reference librarian and digital resource officer, and a Yale computer science graduate. The comings and goings of the 20 or so characters and the multiple plots and subplots in your book reminded me of Steve Martin, Martin Short, and Selena Gomez running around in the Only Murders in the Building series on Hulu. I was also reminded of the Andy Griffith Show from the early 1960s. And I think you actually refer to Barney Fife in the book.
Yes, there probably is a Barney Fife. And not to plug other people, but Only Murders in the Building is one of my favorite shows right now. It's brilliant.
It is brilliant. So let's start. Tell us about the Brooklyn North murder and what inspired you to write such a multifaceted mystery novel.
This is where I get in trouble, because this is where I explain that no sane person would say, I set out to write a novel about Svetan Todorov's typology of detective fiction, as well as being a good, clean murder mystery.
Well, now you've got to explain that.
Okay, Svetan Todorov. The postmodernists absolutely love mystery fiction, and I suffer from postmodernism and a PhD. It'll do it to you. Anyway, there's a whole literature about Edgar Allan Poe and the Purloined Letter as well, if you're interested. That makes a tangential appearance. But Svetan Todorov writes an article where he argues that the murder mystery is a story about reading and writing, where, let me get it right, the reader and the detective are poised against the writer and the criminal to work out the narrative of what happened. There's also a lot of narratology about where the narrative starts. It's all terribly technical after that. But I was very intrigued by this notion that this is really a book about reading and writing, not about killing people or justice or anything like that. That's Todorov's argument. Despite the name, he is actually one of the seminal French postmodernists, as we call him. So I started with that. Maybe I'll wait for Howard's next question, which is, where did the AI bot come in? I guess I'll throw it back. The AI bot came naturally because I wanted to talk about writing, and I wanted to talk about how you write mysteries. And I sort of have a reader and a writer. Doyle is a very bad writer of mystery fiction because he's an AI bot. He has a database of every single mystery that's ever been written. Whereas Watson, the narrator and protagonist, is a reader and a librarian, a custodian of books. So that's where the whole idea of an AI bot came from, as well as the fact my husband does this for a living. I know, don't blame him.
So what is the timing of when you began the book and when we all learned about ChatGPT?
The book has gone through three major overhauls, and I don't know how many underhauls or little overhauls, but it probably started before the pandemic, actually, so 2019. And I guess sitting alone in the house, wondering if my publishers were alive, gave me plenty of chances to rewrite it. So the genesis of the AI bot was pre-pandemic. they did exist then. Needless to say, right now, now that the book is out, and for those of you not in publishing, there's always a year from the moment that you actually have the editor say, okay, we're going with it, to when it actually shows up. So it's having a moment now. This was sort of settled with my publisher and editor. July would be the final, as we like to say.
So way before we all knew about ChatGPT or were familiar with AI bots and using them in one way or another.
Right. It's just exploded these days. One of the gossips or the thing, at least among writers, that has made it explode is there's a short story magazine called Clark's World, and he closed down submissions because he said he was getting too many submissions from written by ChatGPT. A lot of writers are now sort of going around and saying, how does he know? On a sideline, without mentioning names, I'm actually tangentially involved with a fellow writer who is claiming plagiarism against another writer who has put up a book in a contest and done very well with the same title as hers, and she argues the same story. I have suggested to her that she should look and see whether they uploaded her text as a learning set for the AI, and that's where it came from, because she might have some recourse that way. It's very hard to prove plagiarism otherwise. Explaining terms. The way AI bots work is they have learning sets, like Doyle's mystery novels. It just gets added in into a database as models, if you will, and then the machine pulls out the patterns. Right now, there are publishing contracts where, if you don't read them carefully, the publisher is asking you for permission to upload your text as a learning set for AI bots. And right now, the Authors Guild is taking a very strong stand against that. Again, for those of you who may wonder how Tom Clancy is turning out books after he died, or Robert Ludlum, there have always been house names.
Right.
Lawrence Sanders, Robert Ludlum, Tom Clancy are the three I can think of. So this isn't really all that far off, except that publishers used to hire ghostwriters to finish out these kind of things. Now they're saying we can have a machine do it. Some of the best in my mind, Robert B. Parker, they actually hire very well-known writers to rewrite or write the sequels, so that you've got a sort of dialogue going on where you've got a very well-known noir writer rewriting Spencer for Hire. And that seems to me a little more imaginative than just churning out.
Oh, yeah. And these well-known writers, similarly, although not with the precision of an AI bot, extrapolate from the prior works. They've learned from the prior works. They're doing something likely consistent with the prior works.
Sure. I mean, they are taking over the characters and the
yes.
stories. But again, the only one I can think of offhand is Ace Atkins, where he is doing the Spencer for Hires. And, you know, he's also adding a sort of Ace Atkins novel in dialogue with the Robert B. Parker novel. So that's kind of interesting. You know, with the others, I'm like, I'm not sure what the difference between a ghostwriter that's uncredited and an AI bot really is.
Right, absolutely. So in your book, I've got a couple of favorite characters. As I said, there are about 20, I think. Doyle is one. And just to make sure we're all clear, and actually the way you introduce him is wonderful. So at the very beginning, the first chapter, I think you're Mary Watson, our primary protagonist, is having a dialogue with someone she's referring to as Doyle without identifying who Doyle is. And I wondered in that first chapter, who is this Doyle? I think it's in the second chapter you mentioned that Doyle is the creation of Mary Watson and Doyle is an AI bot, but you've given him a name. He's one of my favorites. Another favorite, also not a flesh and blood character, is Lillian Virginia Mountweasel. Why don't you talk about that a little bit? I think that's an interesting sideline to your book.
That is another of, you know, my postmodern rabbit holes. Lillian Virginia Mountweasel is a completely fictional entity who now has a life of her own. Supposedly, she was an intrepid reporter for Combustibles magazine that died in an explosion.
And she was born in Bangs, Ohio.
In Bangs, Ohio, yes, which does exist. The original version of this book was called The Mountweasel Murder.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. And anyway, what she is the kind of entry. She is now a noun, a Mountweasel. And she is an entry that encyclopedists and dictionary writers will put in to catch plagiarism because it's a completely fictional entry. And you now know if somebody's picked up your information wholesale because they've included these entries. There are others of them. There's a whole cult of these things. I suppose I have to add that there's a scene in here where they go on the dark web looking for combustible magazines. That is taken from life, and I feel like I should have put a disclaimer in the front of this. I was messing around on the internet looking up combustible magazines. I got a website just like described, and there was sort of nothing there except a phone number. And I'm married to a computer scientist, so I'm not going to be stupid enough to actually put my own computer at risk. But I did sort of take a landline and call the phone number, and it was the dark web.
So
nobody go in there. Nobody. It is not authorized by me.
That's funny. So as I said, there are about 20 characters. I love Doyle. I loved our Lillian Virginia Mountweasel. Which other characters did you develop an affection for?
Oh, Byrne. You've got to love Byrne.
Yes.
You may love Byrne more. Byrne is sort of the muscle. He sort of was one of these characters. St. Hubbins, who's kind of the jerk that's always making up stories, was meant to be sort of the romantic interest for her. But Byrne sort of said, hey, look at me.
I did not like Nigel St. Hubbins.
Yeah, you're not supposed to really like him.
Oh, good.
He's a charming liar.
Yeah, exactly. But Burns, who's the campus security chief, former special forces, he's got a soft side to him and a hard side to him. And he was fascinating. I liked him.
He is for me, if Doyle and Watson are all about narrative, I'm sort of hoping he's the one. He's a former special forces commando superhero, whatever you want to say, that is now trying to just settle into a quiet life as chief of campus security. So he's the one with all these narratives in the background that you sort of have to believe, and he doesn't want to talk about them, whereas Doyle and Watson will just spin out anything.
Especially Doyle.
Especially Doyle.
Yeah. So you've alluded to this, and you mentioned specifically in the book that Doyle writes news stories, or Mary Watson mentions or describes Doyle saying he writes news stories by extrapolating plots from the old ones. And as I said, that sounds a lot like ChatGPT. What I did, I had thought about I actually asked ChatGPT to come up with questions for you. I described you and the book. And the questions that the AI bot came up with were similar to my questions, for better or for worse. But then I decided that I would give ChatGPT the names of the 7 mystery novels you've published and ask for a 50-word plot that extrapolates the plots from all of those novels. And I'd love to have your opinion of how the AI bot did. So I'm going to read it to you.
Oh, this is fascinating. I love it.
Okay, And I've only read you so far. I've only read The Brooklyn North Murder, so I don't know how accurate this is. So here's what ChatGPT came up with. Eric Obie's mystery novels explore the darkest side of human nature, often centering around women and their struggles for independence and agency. From the eccentric Wunderkammer of Lady Charlotte Guest to the corrupt politics of The Brooklyn North Murder, Obie's characters face danger, betrayal, and loss as they navigate complex mysteries that challenge their beliefs and identities. Along the way, they find unexpected allies, confront their own demons, and ultimately discover that justice and redemption are possible, even in the face of overwhelming odds.
That's a riot. I would love to broadcast this to all my fellow writers who are worried that ChatGPT is going to take over their work. That has nothing to do with anything
I
write.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
I might point out that the heroine of The Wunderkammer of Lady Charlotte Guest, which is my published dissertation, is an 1820s translator of Welsh Arthurian literature, well-known educator and social reformer in the 1820s to 1840s, really. And then she becomes a very famous China collector. And my incredibly undistinguished argument was that the impulse toward collection, which I'm fascinated with, is both behind her being a folklorist and collecting these Arthurian narratives, and the collection of China, which again is a connoisseurship for her. I'm very fascinated by these sort of learned ladies of the 19th century, because this is when you get professional professors, especially of history and art and literature. And the women, they don't have access to that yet. So they become experts in lace making, or China, folklore, this one of the big things. I do sort of have plans for this blog on these learned ladies. Right now I'm just collecting them. I've got enough problems.
But she sounds, in today's day and age, she sounds eccentric.
She's interesting.
And yes.
She sort of appears in Dazzlepaint in the guise of, Dazzlepaint is a historical novel about the Birdcliffe colony where both of us live.
Yep.
And I'm very fascinated by these sort of do-gooders who do good, but are very much a product of their privilege. And I don't want to tear them down. Lady Guest is much easier to defend. She's Lady Charlotte, not Lady Guest, than Jane Whitehead. The anti-Semitism at Birdcliffe is unspeakable.
Historical anti-Semitism.
Historical,
thank you.
Right,
yes.
Quite. It's very hard to defend those two. Lady Charlotte Guest, I have one anecdote that just sums her up for me. She is still remembered in Wales as she founded schools for all their laborers. Her husband is an ironmaster, and they have mines, and there's still pubs named for her because they founded schools. John Guest, you've got to love what they said about him, her husband, is every time he spoke in Parliament, someone lost money. Lady Charlotte sort of founded these schools and flounced home going, some young ladies don't know how to spell Thessalonica. But the story that just sums her up for me is she found an 8-year-old in a very dangerous job in the mines, minding a door. And she came home and she wrote in two diaries, they will tell you they're 12 years old and what are we supposed to do? And so she finds the child, she was very disturbed by this, she finds the child a better job up above ground where it's safer to keep working. And you're torn. I mean, her upset is very, very real. And yet you also want to go, here's another solution. Why don't you just pay the parents a living wage so that the kids can really take advantage of the education you are giving them? And I'm very fascinated by her. You know, this impulse to do good that doesn't quite get beyond the fact that, you know, she was an earl's daughter and they're incredibly wealthy. They have three homes, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. So coming back to the plot that ChatGPT created, wholly unrelated to your works.
Completely.
Yeah. So there was other questions I asked where the response was, I don't remember how exactly it was said, but I don't have sufficient information. So I don't know how much of your work was reviewed. The Lady Charlotte Guest piece, that was your PhD thesis?
Yeah.
Is that online?
Yes. I mean, it's still available for sale.
Well, no, but online. I wonder if...
So it shouldn't be.
Yeah, yeah. So anyhow, so that it is interesting and illustrative. And as so my son Dave, who is my, among other things, AI advisor, said, look, always look at these as a first draft and as something to question. And obviously that's the case here, more so than ever. Moving on. So what was your writing process like for Brooklyn, the Brooklyn North murder? How did you come up with the idea? And maybe for your other books as well.
Chaotic. I keep trying to say, we like to say in the business, there are plotters and pantsers. Plotters have the whole plot going. Pantsers.
Seat of the pants?
Seat
of the pants, yeah. And you?
I try to be a plotter, and then I overhaul things. This is one of the stories, I can tell it, I guess. As I said, this went through three huge overhauls. The Mount Weasel murder has nothing to do with the Brooklyn North murder. And I had sent it to my editors, my publisher, and I hadn't heard from them for a year. And I finally said, that does it. I'm rewriting this book. The whole triathlon disappearance of the tech billionaire was one of the last things I added.
And the very first thing in the book.
Yes. It was a whole different thing. So I started to rewrite it, and this is publishing for you. They came back with the contract at that point. And I said, can I have 8 weeks? Which is why I can show you all the things that are wrong with this book. And they said, sure, you can have 8 weeks. And so I rewrote the whole thing in 8 weeks, starting with this guy diving in the water and disappearing. That's par for the course for me.
Well, so you try to be a plotter, but ultimately seat of the pants.
Then I go down another, you're probably telling this from this interview. If there's a rabbit hole, I'm going straight down it.
Well, yes, I can tell that, but that's great. So what's next? What are you working on now? Or are you working on something new?
Oh, three things. Why do you ask? I am working on a sequel to Brooklyn North called The DeCoverly Riddle. And all I'll say is you all really want to see Byrne put a big hurt on a country dance, don't you? I am working on a very overly pretentious, you'd said science fiction, I'd say it's fantasy, historical fantasy, called the Pevensey Codicil, which the Inklings and C.S. Lewis are near and dear to my heart. My father sent to England, so now you know how old I am, to get the Narnia books for my 7th birthday, and best birthday gift ever. So what always bugs me about Narnia is Susan Pevensey, who is the one at the end where all the three, Lucy, Edmund, and Peter, they go to heaven, or Narnia, and Peter sort of goes, Susan is no longer with us. Da-da-da-dum. I'm like, I'm writing Susan's story.
Nice.
So that's the big pretentious one. And I'm also sort of doing another murder mystery series about a Woodstock slackers. He's a son of a Woodstock rock star who inherits an earldom over in England where his father has, you know, disappeared for 2 years and blah, blah, blah. Yes, there might be models from life, but I won't tell you.
That's great. So with all of your writing, and that's a lot going on at one time, do you keep up with your reading as well? Are you reading anything interesting? You must be.
It's a hard question because I judge and I review.
Yes,
I just finished judging a contest that was about 150 books in a year. That's kind of work reading. My proudest accomplishment was a contest that I actually seriously read 582 books in a year. That's just the pinnacle. Never try that again. Right now, I read mostly classic mystery. John Dixon Carr, Clayton Rawson, big favorites. They're both locked room people. I read those for fun. I read around in folklore, and I'm also reading Anglo-Saxon riddles for basically the Woodstock Earldom book. It revolves around riddles. I'm very fascinated with them. And there's an Exeter manuscript of Anglo-Saxon riddles. And I try to read one a day, and I, of course, pretentiously try to teach myself Old English. I think I'm up to weak verbs at this point.
Well, you've got a lot going on. Thank you. This has been a terrific discussion. I really appreciate it.
I think it's great. I mean, it's all worth it just to hear what ChatGPT would make of me. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. More information about our guest today can be found on our website, www.bookwormsinthewild.com, which also includes links to the books and other resources we referred to in our discussion. Thanks especially to my podcast team. Dave created the podcast with me and is my producer, as well as my AI ChatGPT advisor. Ron is responsible for art direction and design for the podcast, our website, and my bookmark. Melanie provides overall creative direction. Ben and Eden, who is my personal Italian-English translator, and Catherine provide additional inspiration and support. And, of course, Carol continues to be my muse. Just about 4-year-old Jake, who is a delight beyond words, continues to encourage the podcast, as does Jake's sweet, energetic, and equally delightful and funny almost 2-year-old baby cousin Francesca, another great source of inspiration for us all. Mighty and Bop continue to make progress in their effort to recruit a gumdrop to supplement their efforts going forward. Thanks to the great Spotify team for making it free and easy to create the podcast. Thanks as well to AJ Falari, who is working on the editing with me. If you liked our podcast, please subscribe. And in any event, let me have your comments either directly on the podcast or at bookwormsinthewild@gmail.com. Looking forward to seeing you on the podcast next time.